Hey, podcasters, it's Thursday. Got a great, great show for you. Two things that have never happened before in my career. One, a guest canceled while I was introducing them. And that same guest came back on an hour later and gave an interview that I've not only never done on my show or come close to, I've never even heard an interview like this. Alan Dershowitz, a guy who has been accused of being one of the guys who's getting, you know, sex from Jeffrey Epstein's girls, he came out of the chute. He said right at the top, there's nothing I won't answer. I am innocent. And he laid out his case, and it's pretty compelling. And a case that he says, because of my support for Trump and my support for Israel, I'm being targeted. It's if he's lying, he's the best liar I've ever seen, and he's the dumbest lawyer I've ever seen. But I don't think he's a dumb lawyer. Also, we went into the details of our Omar special, a little bit about the Mueller testimony, and a song for the squad, something that we found in history. You know, Trump is such a racist for saying, you know, go home if you don't like it. Omar and Tlaib, they suggested in 2012 in tweets that they should deport Donald Trump. That, of course, isn't racist, but we found something in history. What if that was said in a song from 1942? Don't miss it all on today's podcast.
And you can watch the entire breakdown of the Ilhan Omar story. We did a special on it last night on TV. If you're a member, go to blazetv.com. Use the promo code GLEN20. It'll give you $20 off. We want you to see this special. So GLEN20 is the promo code. $20 off at blazetv.com.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
I think we want to start with the media that was just crushed by the Mueller testimony. Here's a little montage.
Everybody here in D.C. counting down to Mueller time.
Pretty much whatever happens tomorrow is high stakes.
High stakes hearing on Capitol Hill.
The stakes are extremely high.
The stakes are so high.
The stakes could not be higher. We are on the eve of historic hearings.
Historic testimony.
Historic.
This is the room where history will unfold.
You really can't overestimate what is on the line for Democrats when it comes to Robert Mueller's testimony.
This is a very big deal. So crucial.
Really, really important. Very dramatic.
Mueller's testimony this morning could be their last best chance to convince the public to support impeachment.
Do you think there's a make or break moment?
Look, it's their make or break moment.
Could the outcome sway undecided House Democrats on impeachment?
What happens here today is likely to be a turning point in the fight over impeachment.
Do you think that it could change the dial on impeachment?
Is going to be very damning.
The recitation of that evidence could be incredibly damaging.
A key moment in the Trump presidency.
Testifying before Congress with the presidency at stake.
This is either going to be the world's biggest event, the Mueller movie, or a dud because there's nothing new.
That question, was the ball advanced?
No. Impeachment's over.
They needed more fuel for any kind of impeachment effort.
So look, on optics, this was a disaster.
A lot of Democrats in particular used the D word and branded this a disaster early on.
Yeah. You know what it reminded me of immediately after, Glenn?
What?
Chris Darden, attorney prosecuting the O.J. Simpson case,
mm-hmm.
against the objections of many of the other attorneys, decided to
put
the gloves on and have O.J. come up and try the gloves. And, you know, everyone was saying, no, it's not a good idea. And he decided to do it. It was his call and he did it. And he owns it now to this day. Mm-hmm. I mean, he winds up with actually an amazing career as an attorney. But he admits it was such a really bad mistake. And that's what this felt like. I mean, Robert Mueller told you, don't call me to testify about this. I'm not going to add anything.
It was like, to use your analogy, it's almost like the gloves, as he went to pick them up and making the final decision, the gloves said, don't do
it. I won't fit. Don't. I'm too small.
And he's like, I'm going to do it anyway, gloves. I don't care what you say. I think they'll fit.
I won't fit. Don't do it. He'll get away with chopping women's heads off.
That's really what it was.
Yeah, I mean, it was that bad. I mean, he didn't even, not only did he not say anything new, which was something we all could have predicted because Robert Mueller told us he wasn't going to say anything new.
He did exactly what he said he was going to do.
Yeah, and I think it was a little worse than that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, he really didn't. He came off as,
I got my pudding.
Yes.
And where's my cup of pills?
It did feel like they were at an assisted living home while he was giving the. That was a little.
It did.
Bit.
I don't. What are shoes? Where are my shoes? Who's talking? Where are you?
There was a bit of that, and look, you know, the guy hasn't done one of these things in 6 years, and it's been a while. However, it's like he didn't even seem to be familiar with his own report.
Okay, so here's the thing. I talked to a judge last night. I talked to a federal judge last night, and I said, so what do you think happened there? And he said, I'll tell you. He said, guys come into my courtroom all the time. And he said, I always say the same thing. Don't want to talk to you. Want to talk to the underlings. No, well, I'm the head of this investigation. Let me talk to one of the underlings, please. No, you're going to talk to me. Okay. And then they start to go into it, and they're like, oh, well, I'm not sure. Let me hang on just a sec. Mm-hmm. He said at one point in one case that he was working on, he said, could I just talk to the person behind you? And what it is these guys, they're not the ones that make the report.
Just like basically figureheads in a way. Like they add credibility. They manage at the perimeter at some level.
Mueller had very little to do with the Mueller report.
Right. And you see this all the time, by the way, in Congress. It's the same way.
Yes.
You know, Ilhan Omar was reading a...
Who?
Ilhan Omar. She was reading a report. Reading a lengthy question, this is a couple months ago, and she referred to the questioning, and she said, what did you do in the Iran-Contra affair? Now she had no familiarity with even the question she was asking and blatantly reading from. She didn't even know what the Iran-Contra affair was.
I don't think she was alive, and she certainly wasn't here.
Certainly wasn't here. But again, this is not. You don't have to be here. We've talked a lot about the Nazi regime. I wasn't there, and I was not alive.
Or so you'll have us believe.
Well, again. Well, I went through Argentina, and then, right. No, but I mean, like, it's one of these.
We sunk the sub afterwards. Oh, I said too much.
But it's like they don't. They're just the face of it. And I think, like, you know, there's a thing that goes on with these the parties that go on in the Super Bowl cities every year. And so they throw these big Super Bowl parties, and they advertise them like crazy. They'll be like, Kendall Jenner, every big whatever.
Caitlyn Jenner.
No, they never say Caitlyn Jenner.
Really?
Kendall Jenner.
But she's so beautiful.
All the other Jenners and Kardashians except for Caitlyn. And they make a big deal about it. And they'll be like, this model and this model will be there. And this celebrity and this sports star. Mm-hmm. And then if you go to the parties, if they show up at all, they show up for 3 minutes, stand at a private table so people can prove that they showed up so they don't get sued, and they walk out to another party where they're getting paid $10,000. And it's like, it felt almost like this. Like, this guy wasn't even engaged in this at all. His name's on it. You know, he's on the ads. Come to the Mueller report. He's going to be talking about Mueller. Mueller's going to be there. He knows the whole thing. In reality, he showed up for 5 minutes.
Get your picture with Mueller.
Yeah. Because, I mean, going through this, we had the impression that here's a guy who, you know, you could criticize the investigation all you want. I think, as we pointed out many times, there's a lot of really important information that came out about Russia. Now, and the Trump part of it was a sideshow. The Russia part was actually legitimate.
And that's he said that in the opening statement. Mm-hmm. You know, you could say whatever you want, but Russia was trying to hack, did try to hack, and they're going to hack again. They're doing it right now.
As we sit here.
Yeah. And he said, I am hoping somebody is paying attention. Whatever. Russia schmusha. Tell me.
Yeah.
In your report.
Yeah.
You left out a lot of really criminal kind of stuff, right?
Right. So we kind of, I think, I was at least operating under the assumption that Mueller was like, look, I want to do this thing. I don't want to be in a media circus. So I'm going to have my lips buttoned. He made no appearances in front of the media the entire time. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't talk to reporters walking to his car. Mm-hmm. Remember, they were like putting helicopters over his car when he's going to like the dry cleaners.
I know.
And but now, like looking at it,
before you ask for 1 hour Martinizing, is Trump a criminal?
That's a solid dry cleaning joke right there. But like I now looking back at it after watching this testimony, it kind of seems like he just wasn't engaged in it. Like maybe he was just
he looked, and I hate to, you know, I hate to say, you know, he's old and senile, but my guess is he didn't even read the damn thing like the night before.
Yeah, it didn't even seem
he
like
kind of just like thumbed through it, and he's like, I'm not gonna say anything, so why read it? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Is that in the, what page is that? 76. Yep. Then that's what I said.
That's what I said. Right.
I mean,
that's what he was doing. I mean, right. At one point they asked him, you know, Fusion GPS is blah, blah, blah. And like, he didn't even seem to be familiar with the organization.
I know.
And it's like, how do you it's in your report.
I know. It's the point of your report.
Yeah. I mean, this is an unmitigated disaster for Democrats.
Yeah. Impeachment is over. Mm. It is absolutely over. They had their best shot. It was, you know what it was? Star Wars Episode One.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. So last night, we did an episode on Ilhan Omar. Now, I just want to start here. Before we get into the episode, I want to start here. Everybody was calling the president racist for saying, go home. Go home. If you don't like it, go home. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, in an honest, loving way, why are you here? If nothing we do is good, why are you here? I would ask that if it was the country or you were in my diner and you were complaining about everything and you kept coming back. Do you know there are other diners? Why do you come in here and loudly complain when the rest of the people are happy here? What are you doing?
Exactly.
I mean, go to another diner.
And it's particularly frustrating in this case. I mean, we used to say this about Piers Morgan when he was doing a show on CNN. He's like, well, you really seem to hate the Second Amendment a lot. You probably just, I mean, look, if you don't like this Constitution, just go back home. You're a citizen of the UK.
Right.
Go back there and enjoy it.
Right.
Like, and that's not a thing of saying there's certainly not racism. The dude's white.
Mm-hmm.
With Ilhan Omar, what's interesting about that one is that we took her in.
Yeah,
this
is a
woman who
was
fleeing civil war.
Correct.
And by the way, I think it was a good decision to take her in and other refugees from areas like Somalia. We've done amazing things for people all around the world, and it's something that we do stand for. We stand for not only as members of the freest country in the world, but also as a person of faith. I'm thrilled that this country has been developed as a safe zone for people who are in the middle of hell, as long as they're good people, and there is some checking process and all of that, that they're able to come over and enjoy a life that is better. However, when you come over here, the fact that you sit here and continually spit on the country after we rescued you from a civil freaking war, it's a little tough to take.
Okay, so now this sounds really racist, but what if this was set to music?
Why does it sound racist? It doesn't sound racist at all.
No. That's what everybody says now. Okay. It sounds racist to say go home. But what if it was set to music? What if that message had been set to music long ago? What if during World War II... Mm-hmm. When you had Germans here in America that had come over from Germany and they were complaining about us, and somebody said, you know what? We've helped. We're trying to help. Why don't you just go home? This I found last night from a friend. They sent it to me and they said, Glenn, Listen to Gene Autry. This is from the movie in 1942, Bells of Capistrano.
Last night as I lay sleeping, a wonderful dream came to me. I saw Uncle Sammy weeping for his children from over the sea. They had come to him friendless and starving, and he took them into the fold. And now while in trouble he needs you, you'll have to remember your oath. If you don't like your Uncle Sammy, then go back to your home or the sea, to the land from where you came, whatever be its name, but don't be ungrateful to me. If you don't like the stars in Old Glory, if you don't like the red, white, and blue, then don't act like the cur in the story. Don't bite the hand that's feeding you.
Don't bite the hand that's feeding you. I mean, now when he's singing it, he's standing, of course, by his horse, and he's singing this, and he's very happy, and he's smiling, and he's just like, why are you biting the hand that fed you? We took you out of really bad situations. We rescued you. We fed you. Mm-hmm. We've given you shelter. And now you're talking down? Now all of a sudden we're a bad place? Just go back to where you came from, wherever that is.
You might enjoy it. Right?
You might
enjoy
you're
it
You're going
more.
To enjoy it more.
Right. I mean, we said this to American citizens like Johnny Depp, right? It's like, you know, Johnny Depp, we're complaining about the country all the time and a lot of these celebrities. And it's like, well, look, you have the means. I mean, you'll probably
Live
like France more.
Yeah.
And you know what? He does.
Right.
He loves France.
And that's great.
He chose it and he loves it.
That's great.
And there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't mean that you can't go see his movies. And by the way, it doesn't mean that any immigrant or refugee cannot be critical of this country. Of course they can.
You know, here's
but
what
it's
I
just
was...
it's constant criticism of just the foundation, every little piece of the country. It's always complaining. It's always saying that everything is horrible. I mean, was she in 2000? Do we have this clip? 2018. Omar talking about white men. Let's listen.
Our country should be more fearful of white men across our country, because they are actually causing most of the deaths within this country. Mm-hmm. And so if fear was the driving force of policies to keep America safe, Americans safe inside of this country, we should be profiling, monitoring, and creating policies to fight the radicalization of white men.
Okay, so there she is. There she is on Al Jazeera. On Al frickin' Jazeera. And she's saying we really should be profiling white men because white men are responsible for most of the deaths in this country. I wonder if that's true. I don't know. Maybe we're the largest share of, you know, white people or the largest group. So we should be, but I don't know if that's true. I mean, look at Chicago. Look at Chicago alone. You know, we should be concerned about man, meaning mankind. You want to fear something? Fear man, as in mankind. Once they stop thinking, once they stop using reason and logic, then you're in trouble.
Right. And logic is not being utilized by so many. I mean, the media is a great example of this. I mean, if you are going to come out and say, as the media is saying right now, Donald Trump's tweets about Ilhan Omar were racist. We know they're racist. We should come out and say they're racist. Don't say they're racially tinged. Say they are racist and he's a racist. Because the idea that you would ask people to leave the country shows racism and there's no other explanation. Well, your first hurdle to clear there is to say, okay, well, can it be utilized in any other way? Could someone use the phrasing that Donald Trump used without being a racist, right? And so I would say your first, I'll give you your first task on that little train and see if you can logically prove that. Explain why Ilhan Omar tweeted the same thing. Explain why Rashida Tlaib tweeted the same thing, that they wanted to deport people and that they disagreed with.
Including Donald Trump.
And in Omar's case, to send them back from wherever they came from, is her quote.
Mm-hmm.
Why did she do it? Did she also do it because of racism? Because if that's true, fine, make the argument. But I would say most likely she was pissed off at someone in an argument and just and said, you know what, get out of my face. So it's an elevated way of saying get out of my face. And you know what? Then you have to also clear the barrier as to why Donald Trump is a jerk to everyone who disagrees with him. There is an entire New York Times, like, mini site inside the New York Times site, which highlights everyone he's insulted since, like, 2015. You're on it, Glenn. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
And there's dozens and hundreds of people, the majority of them white. And when people call him out or they do things, that's obviously, as we all know, the way Donald Trump deals with it. He comes after him. He punches back. He insults them. He makes fun of them. He degrades them. It's one of the things he does. So why does he do it to all these white people, number one? And number two, why do you keep pretending every time he does it to someone who isn't white, you know that it's racism? He does it to everyone. This is not something that is unknown. There is not a case here unless you just believe it. If you believe he's a racist and you want to apply that motivation to everything that he does when it involves a person of color, you can do that, but that's not journalism.
So, I don't believe that that is the case with Ilhan Omar. As we delved into this last night, and I urge you, this is the beginning of the story. This is not the end of it. I have rededicated and reallocated some resources to furthering this story because I think we are at the tip of the iceberg. I think this story is part of a much bigger story. And we're going to spend a couple of weeks working on this, and I'll tell you what we find. But I want to go back to Ilhan Omar and her story because it is riddled with fraud and felonies. If you want to talk about the biggest liar, I mean, at the core of who she is, at the core of her name, I believe she's a liar and has committed felony after felony after felony. If you want the evidence, watch last night. We had all the documentation there, and it's a compelling case. You can subscribe to the Blaze, blazetv.com, blazetv.com/Glenn. Use Glenn20, and you'll receive $20 off of your yearly subscription. So Glenn20 is the promo code. blazetv.com/Glenn.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and you're listening to the Glenn Beck program. If you like what you're hearing on this show, make sure you check out Pat Gray Unleashed. It's available wherever you download your favorite podcasts. If you don't know who Alan Dershowitz is, it probably is your first couple of months in our country. Probably the most famous lawyer alive today. He has represented everyone from Ted Kennedy at Chappaquiddick to O.J. Simpson to Jeffrey Epstein. And he knows Jeffrey Epstein. And recently he has been accused of being one of the guys who was getting minors to give them massages. He says that is absolutely untrue. And I tend to believe him only because I've seen this guy. And he, for instance, he's not a guy who's going to vote for Trump, but he sees something and he feels that it is right. And he says it no matter what the cost is to him personally. And I wonder also if this isn't part of the price he's paying for his defense of Donald Trump. Welcome to Alan Dershowitz to the program.
Well, thank you. You know, I have never refused to speak out on this issue because I'm a victim of crime. I'm a victim of conspiracy to commit perjury, to suborn perjury, extortion. And I want to speak out, and I'm going to continue to speak out about this. I'm going to write a book about it called Suitable for Framing. Let me state just categorically first, I never met these women. I never heard of them. It's a completely made-up story. This is the only Me Too case in history where there is no relationship between the accuser and the accused. In every other case, yeah, we had sex, but it was consensual. Yeah, she worked for me, but I didn't touch her. In this case, I categorically never met or heard of these people. And they both said so in emails, in recordings. They both said so until they met David Boies. And once they met David Boies, and David Boies promised them big paydays, they changed their story, and they then falsely claimed in one case that I had been the lawyer for this woman, I never met her, and that she participated in a threesome with me, but not my style, and that, and the other case that I had sex with her seven times on an island that I had never been to except with my wife and daughter, in a ranch, all these exotic places. And I have records, my travel records, my TV records, my court records, my American Express records, that categorically prove I could never have been in any of those places. And best of all, I have a tape recording by David Boies, the woman's lawyer, who tells me on tape that it was impossible for me to have been in those places and that his client is, quote, wrong, simply wrong. And then I have emails from the woman accusing me to a friend of hers who was working on a book with her, saying, I don't remember who I had sex with, just tell me. And then she responds by saying, well, we know you didn't have sex with Dershowitz, but you should mention him in the book. It will help you sell the book because he wrote Reversal of Fortune. And then she puts me in the book as someone she did not have sex with. So the evidence is just overwhelming and conclusive. On their side, all they have are two witnesses who have long histories of lying. In one case, the first woman, Virginia Roberts, claimed she had dinner with Al Gore and Tip O'Gore on Jeffrey Epstein's island. Al Gore and Tip O'Gore have never met Jeffrey Epstein. They were never on the island. She claimed she had dinner twice with Bill Clinton, who was flown to the island by a rookie novice helicopter pilot with Secret Service agents on the plane. Secret Service records prove that Epstein was never on the island. This other woman who accused me has emails she wrote to the New York Post saying she has sex tapes of Hillary Clinton, of Donald Trump, of Bill Clinton and Richard Branson. And in the email, she mentions all the people she had sex with, never mentions me. She says I was her lawyer, which isn't true, but she never says she had sex with me. So that's the quality of the two women who have accused me for money. And on my side, I have all this evidence. On the other side, there's never been a clearer case of innocence. And yet the media doesn't believe it. And people don't believe it. They say if a woman says it, it must be true. If a man denies it, it must be false. And if a man denies something like this, he has been being abusive to women. How dare you call a woman a liar? My God, that's the worst kind of sexism. Well, I'm going to continue to call these women liars, and I'm going to continue to call their lawyers people who helped put them up to these lies, because the evidence is clear. They never accused me until they met their lawyers. So it's an open and shut case. And yet newspapers and the media still carry stories accusing me falsely. The New Yorker is about to write a hit piece on me. And I have evidence that the editor of the New Yorker told people the reason they're doing a hit piece is because of my support for Trump's legal rights, wow, my support for Benjamin Netanyahu, and my support for Israel. And they're trying to silence my voice explicitly. They think they can destroy my career and my integrity by making these false accusations, and then I won't stand up for the legal rights of Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the state of Israel.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there. But first,
I will not refuse to answer any question. I'm an open book. I did nothing wrong. I've had sex with one woman during this relevant period of time. My wife, who I love, I adore, and who is helping me in this case, she's been basically my paralegal and my assistant. I have nothing to hide, nothing to be ashamed of. Shoot away. Ask me any question. I will answer.
See, this adds so much credibility to you because no man in your position and seen what happens to dirtbags and how stupid that would be to say those things if they weren't true, because somebody's right. going to go out to try to prove it, prove you wrong.
Contrast it. The two women who have accused me refused to speak to you, refused to speak to the New Yorker, refused to speak to the Miami Herald, refused to speak to the New York Times. They only make the accusation from behind the litigation privilege because they know if they say it in court papers, then I can't sue them for defamation. And the whole plot is they accuse me in behind litigation privilege in court papers. They leak it to the press. Then I deny it in public to the media, as I am doing right now, and then they sue me for defamation. That's the plan, and that's the way they're hoping to make more money. But I'm not going to settle this case. I'm going to litigate it and prove that they have committed perjury, and I'm going to try to get the FBI to investigate both me and them to see who's telling the truth and who's lying. I'm confident of the result.
So one of the people, and you started with David Boies, and right. most people probably don't know who he is. I remember him as the guy who defended Al Gore in the 2000 election, but he is probably, you know, one of the top five attorneys in the country. You came out swinging and said that you are, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to put words into your mouth because I know you're careful with words, but it sounded to me like you're saying he framed you.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I am saying that he was part of a system where these women, and he was their lawyer, framed me. Remember, he's also the same lawyer who was representing the New York Times and hired people to extort, threaten, get information on a New York Times reporter. And the New York Times thought it was such a horrible conflict of interest, they fired him and wrote an editorial. He tried to stop the Me Too movement by trying to prevent the New York Times from publishing material about Harvey Weinstein. He's engaged in similar tactics with other women. His history with women is horrible, and he's trying to now compensate for that long history by supporting women, but he's destroying the Me Too movement because I'm going to prove at trial that these women made up a story for money, and it's going to hurt the Me Too movement. I don't want to hurt the Me Too movement because it's very important when we're dealing with truthful stories, but you know, I think it was Eric Hoffa who once said, every cause starts as a movement, it then becomes a business, and ultimately it degenerates into a racket. And David Boies is turning the Me Too movement into a racket to try to obtain money from people who are telling lies to help him and to help themselves.
So why would, I mean, you know, you always hear that attorneys would just don't turn on each other, and, you know, it's almost like a thin blue line kind of thing. Why does he have it out for you? Why would he pick you out of all the people that he could pick from?
Well, it was a very carefully planned plot. They went to me. They accused me in public, and then this is undisputed. He admits this. He then went to Leslie Wexner, the billionaire owner of Victoria's Secret, and basically said to Leslie Wexner, "The client who's accusing Dershowitz publicly is accusing you privately. No one knows about it. It's a secret. And if you want to keep it a secret, if you don't want to have happen to you what happened to Alan Dershowitz, there are ways of resolving this, even though it's well beyond the statute of limitations. And according to the best friend of the woman who publicly accused me, they were seeking $1 billion, not $1 million, not $100 million, $1 billion from this man who was worth $7 billion. And of course he'd be willing to pay $1 billion not to destroy the company, because the one big difference between what I was accused of and what Wexner was accused of, Wexner was accused of not only having sex with this woman, but making her wear Victoria's Secret type lingerie when she was underage. Imagine what that would do to a company if it came out. And so the question is, we know from his own affidavits, David Boies met with Leslie Wexner's lawyers. Leslie Wexner's lawyers described it as a shakedown. Leslie Wexner's wife described it as a shakedown. He met with the lawyers, David Boies personally, and after meeting with the lawyers, Leslie Wexner's name disappears from the public record. He's no longer a witness. Nothing is. He's not accused of anything. There are only two possibilities. One, David Boies didn't believe his own client about Leslie Wexner, and he thought Leslie Wexner was innocent. But if he didn't believe his client about Leslie Wexner, why did he believe her about me? Or second, he believed her and decided simply to be charitable and not go after this billionaire, instead go after this law professor. That's absurd. And so I think federal authorities ought to look into whether there was an extortion plot.
Now, if there's one person I'm not going to wrong, I think I would wrong a billionaire that sells underwear over you, because I know your record of winning. I know who you are. Why in the world would he pick the Alan Dershowitz?
Well, first of all, I filed bar charges against him, so he was furious at me. And so he threatened me through other people, saying, unless you withdraw the bar charges, we're going to find another young woman, because two are better than one. And so he found this other woman who had written emails saying she had sex tapes of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and Bill Clinton, etc. It was a combination of economic motives and rage at me for calling him into account in front of the Bar Association. And, you know, at this point, he can't pull back because he's gone so far. But he says in one of his affidavits, he thought it was initially a mistake to go after me because he knew I would fight back. He also, it was a mistake to go after me because he knew I didn't do it. He knew I was not that kind of guy. I taught at Harvard 50 years. It was never a complaint for any kind of misconduct. I've spoken to, 1,000 audiences. I take pictures with the people after. Never had any Al Franken moments. I don't touch people. I'm not a huggy guy. I'm not that guy. I've had a wonderful marriage, wonderful children and grandchildren. He just picked on the wrong guy, and I'll be able to prove that.
I will tell you this. One of the things that we were talking about last night when I was talking to somebody about having you on was, if there was ever a guy who was in the position to be Me Too'd, it would be a guy who was hanging out with young, impressionable college students at Harvard when you're Alan Dershowitz. I mean, if there was any, I'm sure you had ample opportunity, and to have zero complaints says something about your character.
No doubt about that. And I was unmarried for about 8 years between my first and second marriages. And I never, ever went out with a student. I never flirted with a student. I always thought it was inappropriate. In fact, I represented several women who had been harassed by their professors at Harvard and worked out resolutions for them. I was always on the side of the people who were harassed or the students, but of course never a complaint. Never a complaint in my entire life. I'm 81 years old this September, and I lived a flawless personal life, and the New Yorker's coming after me. They're claiming I forced my first wife to have an abortion. My first wife never was pregnant. She never had an abortion. Unfortunately, she was mentally ill, and we have records of that. And her lawyer didn't believe it or allege it in the divorce. I got custody of my kids. I was a wonderful father. I am a wonderful father and grandfather. But they're trying to dig up every possible bit of dirt, the New Yorker, in an effort to silence my voice, because they don't like what I'm saying about Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, or the state of Israel.
He's been called the top lawyer of last resort. He is the best known criminal lawyer in the world. His name is Alan Dershowitz, and he is providing a remarkable interview. And I would like to invite you, sir, to bring your evidence. And I do a podcast once a week, and it's a 90-minute uninterrupted interview that I'd love to have you show the evidence and make your case.
Happy to do it. Okay. Happy to do it. Look, I could show you the evidence against me in 1 second. It doesn't exist. There is nothing, because my two accusers won't even speak on the record or off the record. They only hide behind the litigation privilege. And then I have this massive evidence, tape recordings, emails. Unfortunately, some of them are currently under seal. We've been trying very hard to get them unsealed. We won a case in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ordering them to be unsealed, but the mandate hasn't yet issued because somebody is appealing from that order. But as soon as they come out, it'll be completely and totally clear that these women never, ever accused me until they met David Boies. And indeed, to the contrary, they both said quite categorically that they did not ever have sex with me. and then change their mind if they were promised a pot of gold by David Boies.
Okay, so let me go to the political ramifications. I find this interesting that this case came out a long time ago. People have known about the private island and everything else. They've known about him for a long time.
Sure.
Clinton was accused, nothing. But the minute Acosta and you and Trump are tied into this, this story breaks wide open. Do you believe that that interest is there because of the Me Too, because of Donald Trump, or because of a combination?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think the interest in me is largely because of Donald Trump. If I had been a strong opponent of Donald Trump, if I had taken the views that my colleagues like Larry Tribe and others have taken about Donald Trump, I don't think the media would be interested in these false accusations. They had already been debunked and proved false before Trump got elected president. They were clearly disproved. They were in the wastebasket of history in 2016. And then Trump gets elected, and I write two books about him and do a critique of the Mueller report. And I'm on, you know, a lot of television critiquing Trump's opponents, and suddenly this all crops up. We know that The New Yorker is publishing this hit piece this coming week or the week after, precisely in order to quiet my voice on Trump. We know that because we have direct evidence from the editor.
What is the evidence you have?
Somebody very close to The New Yorker told me about hearing directly from David Remnick and from Connie Brook. Take, for example, Connie Brook, the woman who was assigned. She has a son who came out and became gay, and the family loved him, adored him, embraced him. Then the same son who was gay came out for Donald Trump and wrote a piece saying, "My family excludes me now. They won't have me to any events. I've been completely shunned." This is the woman they assigned to write the hit piece on me. She spoke to all my enemies. She went back in history and found every conceivable thing that you can say negative about me from enemies, many of them provably false, and she puts together this article for the express purpose of silencing my voice. She's a woman who has come out strongly against Trump, against Netanyahu, against Israel. The same is true with David Remnick. And so we will prove it in court, because I will be suing The New Yorker for reckless disregard of the truth and for publishing material that's clearly false. They think they can hide behind the litigation privilege, and I think the courts are ready now to say, no, 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 that tactic won't work anymore. You can't accuse somebody in court, refuse to confirm it in public, and then sue him for defamation for truthfully defending himself. Look, it's everybody's First Amendment right under our Constitution to call a false accuser a liar. That's what I've done. And so I've been sued by David Boies for calling Virginia Roberts a liar. And I'm going to prove that she's a liar. I'm going to prove that David Boies is complicit. And so I'm looking forward to a trial. I'm also trying to invoke the First Amendment in the case and argue that I have a complete right to defend myself. Mm-hmm. This has become very political. And to deny any American the right to defend himself in the court of public opinion when they've been accused in court papers would be so un-American.
Some people are mad at you because you did the deal that got Jeffrey Epstein the greatest, I don't even know what you would call it, the luxury condo jail suite kind of a deal. And people are upset at you about that.
Understandably, and they should be. It's my job. If any people who are upset at me got in trouble and hired me to be their lawyer, I would try to do the same thing for them. It's the job of the defense lawyer to get the best result possible. It's the job of the prosecutor to try to get the worst result possible, consistent with ethics. And it's the job of the judge to do the right thing. But you can't blame a defense attorney for trying to get a good deal for his client.
But you know, this is part of the problem, though, in America. And I don't even know what you think about Professor Hayward. I think that was his name. What is it?
I think you're talking about Ronald Sullivan Jr. from Harvard?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Oh, Sullivan. Oh, that was terrible. Yeah.
He was on the Harvey Weinstein team. The students get him kicked out of the school. This is in Boston, where John Adams was the guy who set up the way you're supposed to be if you're a defense attorney. You have to take cases of even the people who are the most despised.
And if you're a professor with tenure, you especially have to take the most despised, because at least before the Sullivan case, you couldn't be fired if you did it. And so, of course, you have to take the most despised cases. That's what I teach my students. Sullivan wasn't fired from Harvard. The law school basically backs him completely. It was the college that fired him from being the dean of one of the residential colleges because some of the women in the college said that they were frightened, that they felt scared to have a professor who defended somebody. This is the same professor who defended many women and who's a wonderful, wonderful man, the first African-American dean of a house, and he gets fired because some women say they felt unsafe. By the way, I think they're lying, these women who say they feel unsafe. How could you feel unsafe in the presence of a professor, his wife, and his children? You just don't like what he's doing, and you use the mantra of unsafe because that's become the latest way of getting people fired from their jobs. Just say, oh, you feel unsafe. Nobody can challenge you because you're a woman. And if you're a woman and you feel unsafe, that's the end of the inquiry. And, you know, I think it was a terrible thing that happened at Harvard, and I've condemned Harvard for doing it. And, you know, people have said, why doesn't Harvard investigate me? And my response is, please, go ahead, investigate me. I will give you all the evidence. I'm dying to be investigated. I called on the FBI in a Wall Street Journal op-ed. I said, please investigate me. That's the only way I can be vindicated. You know, we have a new word in the vocabulary now, exonerated, based on yesterday's disastrous hearing with Mueller. He said the president wasn't exonerated. That's not a legal principle. You know, a prosecutor is supposed to either say prosecute or not prosecute. But I am looking to be exonerated. I want to be totally exonerated because I am totally and completely and categorically innocent. It's not a gray area. Either I'm committing perjury or my false accusers are committing perjury, and I want the FBI to determine who should go to jail. I will not invoke any privileges. I will say the truth. Let the FBI determine who's telling the truth.
We don't really send people to jail now for perjury.
Unfortunately, that's too bad, especially in civil cases. And I wish they did, and they should, because otherwise lawyers tell their clients, hey, don't worry about lying a little bit in the deposition. Nobody goes to jail for committing perjury in civil cases. People should go to jail for committing perjury in civil cases. And I'm inviting a criminal investigation of my testimony because I will testify unequivocally that I never met either of these women. And if I'm lying, I will hold my hands out, let the handcuffs come, and put me in jail. But if they're lying, they should go to jail along with their lawyers.
So I want to leave you with this one last thought. This came from New York Magazine. They wrote Alan Dershowitz cannot stop talking.
Right.
I mean, it's a strange article when you read it. But Boyce says, to me, it's clear Mr. Dershowitz will never be made whole. Toward the end of our morning in the vineyard, Dershowitz stepped out of the room to have yet another crisis management call with his lawyer. I took the opportunity to ask Cohen, your wife, how she hoped to see this case between her husband and his accusers resolved. She said, and I quote, my hope, my greatest dream, would be for this to be revealed as a sinister plot by Boyce, that he gets what's due him, and Alan gets totally exonerated. And the Me Too movement pulls back some and becomes a more reasonable, due process-oriented, valuable movement. This alerts us to the dangers of being too fanatical. The balance of presumption, she says, has tilted too far. It's like all men are evil.
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful wife. I am so lucky to have this woman, Carolyn Cohen, from Charleston, South Carolina, as my wife. And I'm so proud of her. And she has been so smart and so wonderful in this case.
Where do we end, Alan, not on your case alone, but the direction that we're headed as a nation? It is proof of innocence, not proof of guilt now.
But even proof of innocence isn't enough. In my case, I've proved my innocence. An accusation today is enough to get the media to turn on you and to try to destroy your entire life by a false accusation. People think that sexual abuse is so heinous a crime that even innocence is not a defense, especially if you're a Trump defender of his rights.
You even had it yesterday, as you pointed out, with Mueller. Wait, you are supposed to find out if the guy committed a crime. And and you just leave the door open and say, well, I'm not really sure, he might have done some other things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're not, that's not the role of anyone that's supposed to be doing that, in law enforcement.
I agree with you. But in my case, I'd be happy to have a commission investigate. They'll find that I did nothing wrong in my personal life. And I strongly believe I wouldn't be in the position I'm in if I hadn't taken the position against the political correct views of liberals and stand up for the constitutional rights of Donald Trump the way I stood up for the constitutional rights of Richard Nixon and the constitutional rights of Bill Clinton. I will stand up for the constitutional rights of everybody. Today I'm standing up for my own rights. I never thought it would come to that, but it's come to that. And, you know, The New Yorker had a piece totally defending Al Franken, attacking his accusers, saying that they were lying. And then they turn around and have exactly the opposite piece about me. And, of course, in Al Franken's case, there are photographs. We know he did inappropriate touching. In my case, there is nothing, zero. And yet The New Yorker is going to come out and attack me ferociously while defending Al Franken. What's the difference? Al Franken is opposed to Donald Trump. Al Franken believes that Donald Trump should be impeached. I have defended Donald Trump and do not believe he should be impeached. I think we should resolve all this by the election in 2020. I'm a liberal Democrat who voted for Hillary Clinton, but I support the rights of Donald Trump to be treated fairly and constitutionally. He's not above the law, but neither is Congress. And they can't impeach him for something that isn't specified in the Constitution. That's the law as well.
Alan Dershowitz, this has been a remarkable conversation. I admire you much more than I ever have. I've admired you for a long time. Thank you so much for spending the time. We'd love to have you come down for a podcast. So
I would be happy to do it. Let's see if we can arrange it.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Sure. Take care. Bye-bye. Well. Bye.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.